Welcome to Secondhand Film Critics, your favorite source for mildly pretentious, semi-uneducated, and highly unqualified opinions on movies. I am your first host. I was trying to say something different and it didn't come out right. I couldn't. My brain doesn't think quick enough. It's too early in the morning.
Too early.
My brain.
Too early.
I'm one of your hosts, Kayla. And I am with
Noah.
Your
I should just
other
keep
host.
I'll just keep that all in. That was great. That was awesome.
Just trying to mix it up. You know, don't mess with the
formula.
I had a dream last night that I bought a house. It was kind of weird because the whole dream was like me and my dad and my mom, because my dad was like advising me on buying the house. We were like being shown the house. So the first half of the dream was just being led through this house and being shown all the rooms. And then the second half of the dream was like us making the offer on the house. And then they were like, oh, did you know that we have like an attic? We didn't show you the attic. And we went up to the attic and they opened this door and someone like screamed. And then all of a sudden there were these massive rats, like rats, like dog sized rats, like the rats in Princess Bride or whatever, the rodents.
Yeah.
And they were like falling from the ceiling and it was awful.
That's
anyway.
A fun dream. But, you know, dreams are creepy and this movie we're talking about today kind of feels like a dream when you're watching it. So there's our segue a little
Not
bit.
Not sure that was the best segue we've had. I give it a 3 out of 10.
A 3 out of 10. this is Apocalypse Now. This is we're doing another installment in our series of We've Never Seen.
Yeah, and we've got a guest on for you later.
Yeah, it's going to be it's fun. If for those of you who don't know, I mean it's pretty obvious from the title, but We've Never Seen is a series where we watch popular movies that we had never seen before, and we watch them and give you our first impressions.
Yep.
Fun times.
Very fun times.
This is our second Francis Ford Coppola movie we've done on We've Never Seen. We did The Godfather a while ago.
I will say this is probably one of my favorites out of the ones we've done so far. I think Fight Club is probably, like, my number one out of the ones we've done, but I think this one is right up there.
Yeah, I think Fight Club, I would probably put this on the same level. Now, I know you wouldn't, but this would probably be maybe close to Titanic for me, but they're so different that it's really hard for me to, like,
so different. Compare wildly them. Different movies.
Godfather, I just need to watch it. There's so much going on in that movie where it's, like, I feel like I feel like even on one watch, I can't give a full-on opinion on it. But this movie is Apocalypse Now. It, what year did it come out? 1979? So,
yeah.
Pretty close to when The Godfather was released in that 70s era of, like, new Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
It's a weird time. I don't, like, watch a lot of movies from this. I don't actively seek out a lot of movies from this era.
Yeah, I think, too, the reason I don't actively watch a lot of those movies that were kind of game-changing Hollywood movies is because I don't really like the topics. I'm not as into, like, very heavy dramas and stuff that's just, like, war and violence. Even, like, The Godfather has a lot of violence in it, which I like The Godfather in that it's not, like, completely violent like this. But, like, this one.
Well,
like,
this one's a lot different, yeah.
But, yeah, you know, the topics of these kind of movies are usually a lot heavier.
Yeah, and I think, like, even the Stanley Kubrick movies, I like more the ones before and after this period, like, either in the 60s or in the 90s that he made. But, like, the 70s, like, I just don't know. It's interesting. It's definitely, they're good movies, but like you said, I don't actively seek them out as much. But as we'll kind of get into, and I think I can speak for Zach in saying that we are glad that we watched this one because it's a good movie.
Yeah, I'm glad I have it in my watch history.
So in this first section, though, we'll give you guys a little rundown of the history. It's not going to be like a definitive history because there's obviously way too much information to cover in like a little 20-minute segment. But we'll give you the highlights, the highlight reel of the Apocalypse Now production.
Pretty wild stuff going on in the behind-the-scenes world of this movie that maybe not a lot of people know about, how incredible the stories are from behind the scenes.
The stories I was reading about the production was just as interesting as, like, the movie itself, which isn't a knock against the movie.
Yeah,
it's just, like, the production is so crazy that it's almost kind of hard to not talk about this movie without talking about the production.
Yeah, right. And, I mean, I haven't seen the documentary.
Yeah.
I know Zach watched it, but I'm not sure how much is covered in the documentary, and I think it would be cool to get around to watching that eventually.
Yeah, I definitely am going to check that out. It was very soon. But we kind of took the Wikipedia article and adapted it to our purposes. So this is not our information from our own brain, obviously, because we weren't on the set of Apocalypse Now. But this is we'll kind of just go through this a little bit. So John Milius became interested in adapting the story Heart of Darkness. I think it was a short story. I don't think it's a full-length novel, but he wanted to adapt it for a Vietnam War setting. And he began developing that film with Coppola as a producer and George Lucas as a director.
I think I read that he originally, George Lucas's intent was to shoot it during, like, still shoot it during the war.
Yeah, because this movie was in development for a long time. So that was, I think Lucas's intent.
Yeah, I think he wanted to shoot it, like, on location, and it was supposed to be more of, like, a mockumentary, like a fake kind of documentary. Mm. Was his original intent, and then I think when Coppola was on as, like, what, an executive producer originally, he was trying to, like, get the production deal, and then it fell through, and then Lucas had Star Wars.
Yep.
And so it just, the cards fell the way they did, where Lucas was like, you know what, Coppola can have this film to direct.
And so, yeah, Coppola took over directorial control. Shooting began on March 20th of 1976, and it was going to be released on his birthday in 77, but obviously that did not happen.
Yeah, obviously it turned into a train wreck of a production with, you know, a good movie that came out at the end, but yeah, it took 16 months instead of...
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, they recast Willard, the main character. Harvey Keitel was going to play him, but then Coppola didn't like his interpretation, and so Martin Sheen came in. So they had to do some reshoots for that. Not too many, but still.
Which, like, is so just different because he had already been there for, like, 2 weeks. And this was supposed to be originally, I think it was, like, 6 to 8 weeks of a production was the original time frame. And so the fact that they had already done 2 weeks of stuff with Harvey, and then were just like, no, sorry, this isn't working out. I think they did end up using some of the shots with Keitel in them from, like the distance shots where you wouldn't have been able to tell who was who.
Interesting.
And I think it was very few, but ones where it was like, you know, they were on the boat and it was a big wide shot.
That's cool. But yeah, more stuff happened. There was a typhoon that destroyed 40 to 80% of the sets. This was shot, I think, in the Philippines. And so it obviously was like a big deal, a lot of money to kind of extend the production within that way and rebuild all those sets. And at this point, like, before they'd even shot most of the stuff, the film was already 6 weeks behind schedule and $2 million over budget. So yikes,
my gosh.
Just gives
and then
me anxiety
they still
talking
had
about
like
it.
Yeah, if the set was destroyed, it's like how much more money has to go back into that.
Yeah. And then so July 1976 filming commenced again, which, again, that was like 3 months after they thought the movie was going to come out. Marlon Brando came during this time to shoot his scenes. He plays like the antagonist, I guess you could say, of the film. And he was very overweight and he was not able to like do the ending that was written. And so they had to rewrite all the ending. He was pretty, obviously, Marlon Brando is like notoriously hard to work with.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because I think that's probably the thing people know the most about is the fact that he showed up to the set and was supposed to be this, like, nicely cut, very, like, important military guy who would have been very active.
Right.
And he was, like, 100 pounds overweight. And was just, like, had not read anything, didn't know anything. And I read that Coppola even was, like, reading the book to him on set. And then Coppola couldn't even direct some of the scenes with him because he was so angry.
Oh, my word. I bet. Him. Yeah.
And then Marlon Brando wanted to improvise lines and not even do the lines. And Coppola was trying to write lines for him. And it was just a whole...
So, Christmas 1976 rolls around. There's a rough assembly of footage, but there's still not an ending. And so, they all return to the Philippines in early 1977 to resume filming.
What a nightmare.
Martin Sheen had a heart attack in March of 77.
Yeah.
And basically, it was pretty close to dying. Like, he struggled for a quarter of a mile to get back to, like, the set. And by this time, the film was already so over budget that they worried that if they told the investors that they wouldn't be able to give enough money to continue the production. And so he kind of just said it was a heat stroke and continued on. So that's like...
Yeah, I mean, he ended up being out for over a month then.
Right.
And then his brother ended up playing kind of some of the
narration
role. Yeah. And did some of the narration. I think he kind of filled in to that gap, which is also just really funny. So then you have three different people who did
yeah.
parts of Willard's role, even though Sheen is really, credited for
right.
it. And I read that they were really worried when he came back, because after he had gone through all this kind of therapy and making sure he was healthy, he came back so much more healthy and fit that, like, Coppola was really worried because Willard he's a fit guy, but hadn't really been that way in the whole rest of the shooting.
Right.
And basically the whole movie, he has his shirt off, too.
Right.
So it's like, you can imagine.
The continuity.
It's almost, yeah, like, where that worry might have come in for Coppola.
But they finally finished principal photography. May 21st, 1977, they shot for 238 days, not consecutive, but like over the course, and they had 1,000,000 feet of film.
Yeah, over 200 hours.
Oh my word. I can't even imagine sifting through that. Like,
it's so much. It's just, I mean, the whole thing just sounds like a legitimate disaster. It's a miracle that they came out of the other end with what they did because of how bad everything was.
Yeah, like, I can't believe that they even came out with some sort of coherent, like, if even if it was, like, not a good movie, it would be impressive if they came out with anything.
Yeah, and that's not even addressing, I mean, those are just the bigger things. That's not even addressing all the issues they had with sets, with finding military vehicles, because America would not loan them military vehicles, or the United States military wouldn't. And they had to, like, get all these helicopters and stuff from other governments on loan. Did you read the stuff about the bodies?
No.
Okay, so I read this somewhere. You'll think this is pretty wild. They obviously killed the, water buffalo on set.
Mm-hmm.
And people were kind of like... Ooh, this people on set, you know, were thinking, I don't know if this is the best thing.
Right.
And a random crew member, when someone said about the water buffaloes, was overheard saying, wait until they hear about the bodies. And they were obviously then that guy was like, bodies? What bodies? And so he took it to Coppola, and they come to find out that there's this tent where they have all these corpses, and they were going to use, like, these actual human corpses, like, in the scenes where their bodies are hanging from the trees, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like, you can't
You can't
like,
do-
where did you get these? And
oh my
they
word.
Apparently had bought them off of somebody, and then it turned out the person they bought them from was actually a grave robber, and they thought they were, like, just unmarked corpses or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that they had actually been stolen, and then the government had showed up there because they knew that, or they found out they had the corpses, and were like, did you guys steal these corpses? And people were almost arrested, and...
That's wild.
Obviously, they had to get rid of the corpses.
Yeah, oh my
word. But they were like, what were you gonna do with the corpses? Like, were you, like... How did you think people weren't gonna find out? They obviously smell, you know, and then... they ended up just using, I believe, extras for the scenes.
In Coppola, it's pretty well documented that, like, everyone on set over this shoot basically, like, lost some semblance of sanity throughout. And so that just shows, like, the lengths they were going to get this made, which I can't even imagine the stuff we don't know. But, yeah, budgets went up, insurance policies were taken out. He asked George Lucas for some money after Star Wars became a hit. Coppola said in September of 77 that he thought, like, he only had a 20% chance to pull the movie off.
Wow.
Production was delayed multiple times, like, because the sound had to be reworked because they had no sound. Like, the sound material they recorded in the Philippines just wasn't adequate because, like, they didn't have the equipment there.
Yeah, I think because of, like, the sounds of the jungle, mm-hmm. and then also because of all the choppers that they used. all the chopper scenes, you couldn't hear their voices, which is obvious.
Yeah.
Because choppers are so loud. But I think that was when they had to do a lot of the kind of voiceover stuff.
Yeah. April 1979, Coppola screened a work in progress for 900 people. Not well received. Same year, he screened a work in progress at Cannes, and that was more well received. I mean, it won the Palme d'Or, so good for that. But it's crazy that it still was like a work in progress. It's the only, at the time at least, it was the only work in progress to be shown in competition, and then obviously also to win.
Yeah.
Then August 15th, 1979, they released it in North America, but only in 3 theaters because they only wanted to release it at that time in theaters with Dolby Stereo that could show 70 millimeter prints.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Obviously, we have the resources now for, like, most theaters have that capability, and then obviously you have IMAX,
mm-hmm.
But, I mean, only 3 theaters, wow.
Especially, like, after that whole production, you'd think that definitely most people would just want to get it out there to get the money back, but...
Yeah.
Shows the commitment, and they didn't release it wide 35mm till October 10th, so about, two months, just... not available. And it didn't even receive great reviews upon release. Like, some people praised it for, like, the experience, but one reviewer I read called it emotionally obtuse and intellectually empty, which is a shot. But now it's regarded by many as a masterpiece of the new Hollywood era, so it obviously paid off in the end. But I wonder, like, what the studio's reaction and Coppola's reaction. Like, imagine working on something this intense for that long, and then you release it, and it's, like, some people love it, but, like, it's obviously still a very mixed reaction. So,
yeah.
A really wild story. It did get a lot of nominations, though. It won for Best Sound and Best Cinematography, both of which I think are good.
Yes, those are probably, to me, 2 of the best parts of the movie.
Agreed.
I'm not surprised that, especially sound, because it did so much innovative in terms of sound design. So I think that's pretty telling.
Yeah, I think that those were definitely deserved. They obviously received a couple other nominations, but I think if I had to pick 2 categories, those would probably be like the biggest 2 I think that the movie really just nailed.
Yeah.
And that's Apocalypse Now. It's, like I said, there's no way we could have even covered half of the stuff that went on behind the scenes. But hopefully that just gives you a little bit of an idea of the production. And just maybe even, like, even as we'll get into in this next half, I don't, like, love everything about the movie, but I have a great amount of respect for it in just that it's made at all. That it made it.
Yeah, for everything that happened, and obviously, like, that's only the surface level, mm-hmm. kind of the bigger moments of stuff that happened. But, you know, if people go read everything else about this film, it's really a miracle that we got a finished product, and especially a finished product that's as respectable as it is. And that stood the test of time as well.
Yeah, like, everyone knows it. It's pretty popular. Even this year in The Five Bloods, there was a big, a lot of nods to Apocalypse Now in that, even in, like, how the bar was called Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, I was going to say, they had the bar called Apocalypse Now, and they had the big, title with the helicopters and the,
Yeah, so. The poster, so.
It's an iconic poster.
It is an iconic poster.
You know, I think it, like, the marketing worked for them in the long run. It, you know, the text, the font that they used.
Yeah, they had a $9 million advertising campaign. And so that brought, like, the total cost up to $45 million. But it made its money back. Obviously, at this point it did. But even in the box office, it got $150. So they did it. Good job, guys. But I think this is a good time, then, to get into our review, where we are joined by Zach Smith-Michaels of the Real Boys Podcasts.
Yeah, so let's cut to a quick ad break. And then after the ad, we'll be back with our thoughts about the film. And we're back.
Yeah, and this time we're joined by a guest, Zachary Smith-Michaels of the Real Boys Podcast. Three different podcasts. Zach, why don't you, like, give just a little rundown of what you do so the audience can kind of get an idea?
Yeah, cool. Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, I'm a part of the Real Boys, which we... Just, yeah, like you were saying, we do different podcasts. They're all related to movies. We have one called Is It Really?, which is about challenging popular opinions on movies. One called Fantasmic, which is specifically about Disney movies. And one called Godfellows, which is just about Christian media. So it's me and my two friends. Each person hosts and edits and kind of runs a different show. And that's how we have all been able to... stay connected as friends, even after we've all kind of moved to different states and spots. So, yeah.
That's cool. I like that. That's it's really a cool setup you guys have. And especially, I think, the Is It Really podcast you guys have fits in perfectly with the We've Never Seen podcast, because usually our opinions on these movies don't align with a lot of other people's opinions, especially if they have a lot of nostalgia for them. Or they've seen them. And so that's kind of what this show that we do is. And so this is the first time we've had a guest on it, because I think it's a lot harder to find a guest for these, because the whole point of the show is watching movies that most people have seen. But this one worked out perfectly, because we were like, hey, have you seen Apocalypse Now? And you're like, no. And we were like, perfect, we haven't either.
Yeah, I should put on, I immediately felt shame when you asked, like, have you seen this? I was like, oh no, I don't want to lie. I was thinking, I was like, you know, because sometimes you're like, do I lie and pretend I've seen the movie?
Yeah, or I've seen it.
yeah, you know.
But it works perfect, because that's what the show's about. We're trying to fill the gaps in our movie history.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you, I mean, I'm assuming you had seen at least... The Godfather 1 going into this.
Oh, yeah. So my first Francis Ford Coppola movie was actually The Outsiders. And,
okay,
like, in high
good
school.
Movie.
Yeah, and it's one that I remember watching thinking, this is better than a lot of, like, the other movies of this genre. Like, it looks better than your kind of Grease or 50s, like, movie about, you know, kids in leather jackets with oily hair doing stuff. So right. I remember thinking, like, well, this, you know, whoever this director is, he's got a clear eye for talent. And then, you know, you get a little older and you hear about The Godfather. So I saw 1, 2, and 3, but the first two just really fantastic, really great movies. And then, you know, Francis Ford Coppola is an interesting one, because then you kind of look at his filmography and, like, he does these great, great movies, and then after that, it seems to kind of, like, peter out with some weird choices. So, you know, I was like, I know he made some great movies, but I think I don't have the drive to go and check out a lot of his films like I would with, like, a Scorsese or a Spielberg or something like that.
Well, it feels like he just got lucky, because
Especially in this one.
As we'll talk about with this one, and maybe even some of The Godfather, like, productions are just a complete shit show. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, how did it happen? Like, was it really intentionally supposed to be like this, or did it just happen, you know? Right.
And I think this movie even more, because The Godfather, I think those films feel a lot more scripted than this movie does. Apocalypse Now, like, as we said in the first part of this podcast, like, they had over 200 hours of footage. So it's basically a film that was, like, made in the edit. And so, like you said, it's like, sometimes it feels like how much of this is luck and how much of this is, like, genius. And I feel like it might be a little bit of both, you know?
Yeah.
Which is why movies like this are so cool, though, because they're really fun to watch and dissect and just, especially in this one, like, read the stories behind the scenes. And I think that, like, this is shorter than, I think, all three of the Godfather films. But this one I just hadn't seen, mostly because it feels more daunting, I guess. Because, I mean, you hear so much of the lore behind it, and a over 2 hour long war movie just says, they're never my thing. So, you know, I definitely was less inclined to check this out than maybe something like The Godfather. But I'm glad, not to give too much of my thoughts, but I'm glad I finally did.
Yeah, and I'm with you. Like, war movies, to me, they're all, most of the time, like, I would say maybe about 8 times out of 10, they feel pretentious, and they kind of feel like overlong. And the thing with war movies is that when filmmakers try not to have an opinion behind them, they just come across feeling hollow. And then when they try to put their opinion in them, it's just like, oh, okay, this is a little ham-handed. So it's like, you really have to get it right if you're going to make, like, a great war movie. Like, I think about 1917, which just came out, like, this past year, and I was like, you know, it's definitely, like, very well made, and it's relying on, you know, the one shot type thing. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, if you can tell a good story but also, like, make it look great, I think that that's kind of the big thing with war movies, is that they have to have, like, there's got to be some level of, like, spectacle, you know, where you can't just have, like, here's your war movie, because a lot of times it's like, war is bad, and there's not much more to say. You have to have something else. Like, Apocalypse Now looks great, and it has, like, amazing shots and really, really, like, stunning visuals.
Yeah, yeah. Great, great thoughts there. Before we get even deeper, I think, into our conversation, let's take a look at this synopsis we have written here. Kayla, you're our, like, resident synopsis reader, I feel like, so do you want to take this one?
Yeah, gladly. So this is the synopsis of Apocalypse Now, because there's an exclamation point. At the height of the Vietnam War, Captain Benjamin Willard is sent on a dangerous mission to locate and eliminate a mysterious Green Beret colonel named Walter Kurtz, a once promising officer who has reportedly gone completely mad. Along the way, Willard and his crew are forced to confront each other, as well as their own personal demons. Will they complete their mission, or will they fall victim to the madness that surrounds them?
Dun dun dun.
Sounds like a horror movie.
It's a cool setup. I mean, and I feel like there is an element of horror, especially as you get through the film, because it's almost like a descent into madness, I feel like. Rather than, like, it starts out more like, I mean, besides the, like, opening sequence, it kind of starts out as, like, a pretty basic structure where, like, we got this crew of dudes and they're going down to complete their mission. But, like, as you get further into it, it turns more horrific and it subverts your expectations for sure.
Yeah, I loved the opening of this movie where it's just, you know, Martin Sheen in a room going nuts and breaking everything, because it immediately I was just like, I feel like there could be an argument for you could have just started the movie with, like, him talking to Harrison Ford about we need you to go get this guy. But I love the idea of you have a movie where you have an unreliable lead character, like your narrator isn't reliable, you can't really trust him because he's kind of losing it and he's going after someone else who's kind of losing it. So it automatically, like, just made me way more engaged in the story than if you had just, like, cut out, you know, the first 5 or so minutes of the movie. I really, really was like, all right, I'm in. Let's go on this journey, and I have no idea what's going to happen, and I'm super excited.
Yeah,
well, I think that scene sets up really well from the get-go that, like, this war is no joke.
Yeah.
So you kind of go into it seeing the effects of PTSD that he kind of already has. And at first you're like, man, I don't really want to see him dragged back into that.
Yeah.
But these people in the movie kind of thrive on that. Mm-hmm. Being back in it, like he says the line, you know, when you're there, you just want to be home. But when you're home, you just want to be there. And that also mm-hmm. kind of reminded me of The Hurt Locker, if you've seen that movie. Where at the end, he ends up going back because he can't function in the real world. But yeah, that scene is crazy. And also, like, he wasn't really even acting in that scene.
Yeah.
Which I read is that he was very, very, very drunk and had a serious drinking problem. And was very drunk when they filmed that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And even, like, attacked Coppola and actually smashed his hand on the glass and all this. And I was like, oh, yikes.
Well, did you hear that, like, Coppola was also, like, talking trash to him to get him, like, to that point?
Yeah.
He's like, you're just a pretty face. You can't do this role. What are you doing here, man? And, like, yikes, you wouldn't do that today.
No, for sure. That there's a lot of stuff in this movie that wouldn't have been done today. But on that opening shot, before we get off it, I wanted to kind of mention, like, I rewatched it after, like, just the opening sequence, because I liked it so much. And after kind of seeing the whole movie, and you see the visual language, and you see the themes, I think they do a great job of establishing that. Like, you have so much of the overlay shots, which will be used again and again throughout the movie. And just with the sound design, like how the helicopter sounds are matched with the ceiling fan, and it really gets you in that hallucinogenic state where it's like you don't know what is real and what isn't real. And I think it really sets up your expectations in such a different way than if it had just started with him, like, seeing Harrison Ford, which there's not enough Harrison Ford in this movie. There's a complaint right there.
The minute I saw Harrison Ford, I was like taken aback a little bit. I was like, whoa. And I was almost wondering if that was intentional because of Star Wars. But when you think about it, they probably shot the Harrison
Ford
stuff
before.
Prior. Yeah.
And I even read that he, like, was allowed to name his own character. And he named his character G. Lucas after George Lucas. Because he looked up to Lucas, but this was before he was even, like, in Star Wars, so that's a fun trivia fact for you.
Wow, Harrison Ford, he really controlled his destiny right there, you know, he knew what he was, he knew.
So, since you commented on the sound design, I've got a little piece for you here that I got out of my handy-dandy History of American Movies film book.
Wow.
Ooh.
So the sound designer, actually, this was one of the first films, American feature films, that didn't have sound, like, married to the picture. So where it used kind of sound that was not as traditional, like you said, the helicopter sounds, in that opening scene. And he said, image and sound are linked together in a dance, and, like, some kinds of dance, they do not always have to be clasping each other around the waist. They go off and dance on their own. And I thought that was pretty cool because sound design is such a big deal in this film, in the way that it's featured, especially, like you said, where they utilize different areas of sound that you wouldn't really think of. And I think that enhances the film a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
I think it modernizes it too, because, like, you have to remember when you're watching this, it's hard to keep in mind this is a 40-year-old movie, you know, and the fact that they were using those techniques then, you really can see how influential it was in a lot of films today. So really cool, really, just like I said, really cool to see, even if you're just looking at it from, like, a historical standpoint. We'll try to keep it spoiler free for a little longer. What were some, like, spoiler free like moments, you know, that, you know, happened with some of your favorite parts? I don't know.
So, not to get too, I guess, heady here, but one of the things that I, and again, like, Coppola has even said, this is a movie that, like, the audience will see what they bring into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I wasn't alive during Vietnam, but I think that there was kind of this assumption that America was kind of like, why are we here? Why are we doing this? Why are we fighting in this war? Like, that seemed to kind of be the thought process of a lot of people, you know, at least when we look back at it in history. So one of the things that I really liked is that aside from the main objective, every time you see like that they're just bombing a town or they're just having like a full out battle, you don't know why it's happening.
Yeah.
You know, like it's never explained like this is happening, because it's like the whole movie is like a big question of why is any of this happening? Why are we doing this? What is our objective? And like even the one scene, like the guy's like, who's your commander? And he's like, aren't you? Like, I loved that element to the movie.
Yeah, I think it gets you in the headspace of the soldiers where you're thinking the same things you're thinking, where it's like, so why are we doing this? Like, not to spoil the entire scene, because I think this is probably one of the most, like, it's the most well-known scene from the film, so maybe I'm not spoiling too much, but just everything with Robert Duvall and, like, the Ride of the Valkyries scene, it's like, during that whole moment, you're just like, what is going on, and why is this happening? And that's kind of the point, because it's supposed to kind of get you in the headspace of what these soldiers were thinking, because they were just following orders that they had to carry out. So, like you said, I think that's a really great part of the film, and it makes it more of just like a depiction of what the Vietnam War was.
Yeah.
Also, something that I didn't like.
Go for it.
That's spoiler free. I don't understand why they needed so much footage of helicopters flying. It felt like every single scene, I was like, okay, we're getting another shot of a group of choppers flying across in front of the sun. And then it was like 30 seconds later, oh, there's seven choppers again flying in front of the trees. And I just was like, this is, it felt like they were like, all right, we got the choppers. It's going to look so cool.
I mean, it looks cool, but yeah.
Well, and then they're like, and I'm going to get in a chopper, and now I'm going to, like, pan and get stuff off the ground because we can film from a chopper. And I just was like, it's just a lot. Like, it works if you're using it less. Like, less is more, I feel like, because it would have been like, oh, wow, that was neat. Like, this one cool shot. But it just was like, oh, more and more and more. Like, it just kept coming.
I think it's better in the beginning. As it goes on, it gets a little more like, all right. Like, again, the stuff in the Robert Duvall scene, because I think there's a lot of helicopter stuff in that. I think that all works really good, especially because that you actually, like, know who's in the choppers. But sometimes it's like, what are we, why, who is this? Like, I feel like I want to be focused on, like, the guys in the boat, because that's who I'm invested in, and that's what I know. So,
yeah.
It does feel like they got a lot of footage, and it's almost like an artsy choice. Like, we have all this footage of helicopters. What are we going to do? Not use it?
You just can't not use the helicopter footage.
We spent so much money on these shots, they have to be in the movie.
All right. I think maybe what we should do, say our overall thoughts on the movie without spoiling, and then we'll just get right into spoilers, because there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about here.
Okay, I'll go first since I feel like mine is the easiest. I didn't love it, didn't hate it. I thought it was just an okay movie compared to some other movies that came out sort of in that same era. I thought the story was dumb.
Wow.
But, like, hot that's takes. Just me. I thought the acting was very good. I thought some of the shots were really pretty. The color was, like, really nice and a lot of stuff. So that was interesting. But overall, I was mostly bored and just thought it was all right.
There we go. Zach, why don't you go next?
Yeah, I think that to go into a movie like Apocalypse Now, I think if you go in expecting to sit back, relax, and watch, you know, an old movie, I think that you're kind of doing yourself a disservice. Like, the way that I watched this movie, which was, you know, with my notepad so I could kind of write out my thoughts, is kind of the best way to do it. Like, it's a movie that if you're in the mood, it'll kind of really get you thinking, and it'll really get you asking questions and, like, kind of digging into different things. But at the same time, like, if you don't want to do that, it's kind of a slow, you know, movie where not a lot happens. I think you definitely have to go in with the right attitude. But again, like, I don't know if that's even fair to bring up, because, you know, good movies are good movies, and I don't think you should have to have the, but if you're in the right mood, the movie's great. I think that as like a piece where you can sit down and go, this is very impressively directed and this is, you know, has great acting and all this other stuff, I think it really works. I think it's a classic for a reason. And overall, I think it's, you know, I think I said in my Letterboxd, it's as good as you don't think is going to be possible.
Yeah, I think I probably fall a little bit in between both of you where, like, I don't love it. Like, mostly more just personal taste-wise. But I really respect it. And I think it's a really just interesting film to think about and even watch. Like, I just like watching it and maybe taking in the scenery or taking in the ideas it's bringing about. But my favorite movies are going to definitely be grounded a little more in, like, individualized characters or different arcs, where there are things you can pull from this movie with that, but, like, it's definitely just more of a personal taste thing that it doesn't get, like, an amazing, like, 5 out of 5 from me. But I definitely would recommend at least watching it once. I think, like, it's definitely one that I'm glad that I have seen.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Zach, you gave this a 4.5. Noah, you gave it a 4. And I gave it a 3.5.
Perfect.
Perfect.
So, like, yeah, I think we all recognize its strengths and, you know, see kind of how it impacted film and impacted a certain group of people that can really invest in the story. But obviously it's not for everyone. So,
yeah.
Cool. Well, let's jump into some spoilers.
What'd you guys think about the ending? Because I feel like this is the most controversial part of this movie. Like, the last act.
You know, here was kind of my thing, and this is going to sound really weird, but I kind of liked that as the movie went along, because a lot of the movie is about, like, you know, what does it cost? What does it take to win a war? And to some extent, it's like losing your humanity. And so I liked that as the movie went on, it was becoming, you know, we start the movie, you know, if you're not thinking about the first 5 minutes, we start the movie in this really nice, like, colonial house in the middle of Vietnam.
Yeah.
And then as we move on, like, even there's a barbecue and stuff like that in the other place. And then, you know, like, as we're going more into the movie, we're losing more of our humanity, right?
Mm.
So I like that when it gets to the end, all of a sudden, it's, like, not even, like, the same. It's not even, like, a real movie anymore. It's just now, like, a crazy fantasy. The thing I did not like is that it felt like they were doing it at the expense of the people of Vietnam, where they're, like, throwing harpoons at them on the boats, because they're like, that didn't happen, and that's, like, kind of pretty offensive to do also.
Yeah, so that's a good point.
It's like, I get what you're saying, and it's cool, but I don't know.
I have a similar view where it's like I like maybe more the idea of it and how as the film goes you're like slowly delving more into like the madness of the war, and it's like you feel like you're losing your mind along with the characters. It just kind of, especially like, I don't know, it feels weirdly underwhelming compared to the rest of the film for me. Like, I feel like it, as it goes on, it loses its edge, which is kind of like the point, but maybe just didn't work as well for me. And I feel like the biggest thing is that, like, it's, I think, the only part in the film where you can see the cracks in how it was kind of put together in the edit, whereas the rest of the film kind of works with that loose structure. But in this, and there was obviously the most issues was in that final act with a lot of Marlon Brando's, like they had to rewrite his whole character, rewrite the ending, a lot of stuff was going on.
Yeah.
So, and I just feel like that's definitely, like, noticeable for me. But there are definitely, like, there's a lot of cool shots, cool moments. I think Dennis Hopper's character is probably one of the best characters in the movie for me, just really entertaining. I just love, he's just completely gripping. And even though I am completely against, like, animal brutality, I think the water buffalo scene is probably one of the most visceral moments in the film, especially paired with the climactic moment of him carrying out with the murder. I think that just, like, a great moment.
Mm.
Kayla, what did you think?
The third act was my least favorite part of the film.
Yeah.
I was pretty invested in the first act, and as the movie went on, I just, like, became a lot less interested.
Mm.
I think, and you can see, like you said, the shortcomings where obviously people, there were rumors going around that there were multiple endings that were shot.
Yeah.
And you can tell that they kind of just went with what maybe they had the most footage for or what worked best for them with the scenes that they had with Marlon Brando that obviously didn't go very well when shooting. So it just makes you wonder kind of when you get to the end. I think that I would have rather the ending where they're all like blown sky high.
That'd be cooler.
That was one of the kind of alternates, was that they did bring in the airstrike, even though they had thought that, like, they had missed it or whatever. So then they all get blown up, and you're like, well, that was for nothing. They should have just thrown in an airstrike in the first place. Yeah, I thought it was okay. Obviously, you want him, you know, you want your lead protagonist to be okay in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of hope that...
But is he after, okay in the end?
Well, no, but you hope that after all of this, he'll come out on the other side and really kind of find safety from the war and find peace that he really, you can tell, has been grappling with this whole time.
Hmm.
And then when he comes face to face with Marlon Brando's character, you're like, oh, he's basically looking at himself.
Right.
He's looking at this guy that's gone through the same thing and found his peace in this way, instead of returning home to that kind of line that he said in the establishing unit where he says, you want to be here, but he kind of found this, I guess, different home with these other people. And, you know, people have wondered, like, oh, does he take their place or his place? Does he leave? Because that was another alternate ending, was him kind of taking over.
Right. The group I think people. I like it better with him leaving.
And becoming their leader. But, yeah, and you kind of see that in him putting down the sword or whatever, giving up violence, but you're like, you just know that he's gonna be roped into this his whole life. But you wonder, and my whole thing with this film is like, are these things that we're interpreting because we think deeply, or was this their intention? Like, was their intention to have this, like, very weighty kind of violence, anti-violence, whatever in this character where he finally hits this turning point? Or was it just like, that was just how it ended, and that was just how it ended up being?
It's definitely interesting to talk about. Like, I feel like Coppola would definitely say that it has the meaning we're giving it, but also, like, obviously he's gonna say that, so we're probably never gonna know.
It's hard because it's like, knowing that there were alternate endings that were filmed, it's like, was that really the meaning? So it's just this whole, it's a whole thing. But I do really like those kind of more psychological scenes and sort of more relational scenes in this than the war scenes, or like all the bombs and when they're shooting up all these people. Like, I enjoyed their more kind of conversational, get you thinking type scenes.
Yeah, I think a lot of the stuff on, like, the boat is really interesting. And, like, it's weird because I feel like there's not a lot of scenes that establish the camaraderie. But I think just when you see all the things they've been through and you're kind of working through them as well along with them, you kind of get that anyway because you kind of feel that emotional bond with them. And, like, Clean's death, that was such a emotional moment. And having, like, I mean, it definitely is, like, trying to be emotional, but just having the mom's recording play, like, it won me over. Like, it was sad. Yeah. I was tearing up. It was good.
Yeah, me too. Young Lawrence Fishburne over there. I was just, ooh.
Yeah, well, and you see, you love him so much. He's, like, surfing along to I Can't Get No Satisfaction. Like, what a great moment.
Yeah. Well, did you see, I wrote in the notes that he actually was 14 when they started shooting? Because he lied about... And it's crazy because, like, this is one of the movies that really launched his career. I mean, and he's, like, a long-time actor, like, very, very well-known. And it's so funny to me and feels very him that he, like, you know, lied about his age and is in this movie. But he's so young and delivers such a good performance. Because it's, like... I mean, his character really ties together a lot of, you know, their time on the boat and capturing the parts of the war that are like, yeah, all of these young kids were sent over here and did enlist and, like, thought they were doing something good and they're just going to their graves, basically.
It's funny now thinking about, you know, all the different soldiers in this movie because... The movie almost makes it seem, you know, like war is bad and we shouldn't be fighting. Like I legitimately, the shot where they're like, you know, in the helicopters and they're like, play music, like as we're flying in, it makes us look cool. And then it cuts to like the school and the children and I like audibly out loud, I just went, oh no.
No, that was such a heartbreaking scene.
Yeah, because you know that like all of that is going to happen. But at the same time, I think then they also... I don't know. It feels like they try to make these guys look cool.
Weird because like, it starts out like it feels like a real anti-war film. And then as it goes on, it becomes more just like a depiction of the Vietnam War. So like it feels like the movie kind of changes like through as it goes on, which like I don't know if that's a negative or is just like maybe Kayla was saying, like, is there really a... main idea this film is trying to portray.
Yeah, I think off of what you were saying, Zach, like the balance between the crew is really good, I think, because it shows kind of all the different people that are there and that were affected by Vietnam, because you have, you know, these older white guys, and then you also have, you know, these black guys that did fight in the war, and then you have these younger guys, and then you have, like, a famous surfer, and it's like, no one who was an American at this time was really exempt from this kind of mass war. But I think you see the kind of balance in that you see Martin Sheen's character, who has been affected by it for years and years and years, and obviously has this huge buildup of how he feels, and you see the contrast on the boat of him just sitting there in silence, and then Clean, who's just happy-go-lucky, you know, drumming on things, and getting in the water, and listening to music, and it's like, you kind of see that for some people who hadn't really been deeply affected by it, we're just seeing this as the propaganda that was pushed to them to enlist. And then it's like, those are the people who are like, all right, let's play the music. Like, let's go surf.
Yeah.
Let's
do
this. And then you have Martin Sheen who's like, no, like, we're just going to shoot this lady and she's going to die because that's how the war works. You know, it's not butterflies and roses.
And to quote a pretty bad movie, I don't know if you've seen Jack Reacher, but he talks about like the four people who join the army. Like there's the people who are real patriotic about it, and then there's the people who do it because like my family's done it. Then there's people who need a job. Then there's like sick people who want to go kill people.
Right.
But then with Vietnam, you have, like you were saying, Kayla, people who... I really don't want to be here right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, like, of course they're going to have, like, beer and steaks in Vietnam when you arrive. And that scene with the playmates, just yikes. But, you know, of course they're going to do all this to make it seem more appealing. I thought that was a really interesting thing that the movie kind of got into that I would honestly like to... I guess learn more about what that dynamic was like between like people who were drafted and people who weren't. And you know, it's something that the movie, I don't think really has the time to explore because it's a pretty long movie, But it definitely hinted at a lot of interesting ideas as well.
Yeah, because you saw it, I think, a lot more exhibited in the, I don't remember his name, but the guy who was driving the boat, where when he was in certain areas, he was comfortable. And then when he had to go and drive him into this other area, even though that was the orders, he didn't want to do it. He was apprehensive, where you kind of wonder, too, do these people, you know, they are either forced or they choose, but there's a certain level to where they're like, I don't want to be doing this anymore. That's too far for me. I want to be in the safe kind of environment where you can still enjoy time with, you know, your crew. But it's like, then once you go, you're like, oh, we are going to die now if we go past this certain point. So then it becomes more real, I guess.
Yeah. What did you guys think of the Francis Ford Coppola cameo in the movie?
it was kind of like, I feel like it was definitely a wink at the audience because he literally plays like a director. But I also think that it added a lot because it kind of supports some of the stuff we've been saying, where it's like, how much of this war was just surrounded by this sense of patriotism and propaganda. And it's like, they're literally going in to kill this whole village of people. And then there's a guy pointing a camera at them like, all right, don't look at the camera. Just go make it look cool.
Yeah.
And it creates such a unsettling juxtaposition where you are kind of forced to confront these certain aspects of war.
Yeah, it's interesting because apparently Coppola was also like really upset at how people took the I love the smell of napalm in the morning line, because like, you know, a lot of people after the screening, they're like, what'd you think? And they're like, oh man, that line was so cool. And like, he was just
that
like,
was not the point.
No, that was not the point. And it's interesting though, because like, you see it like parodied in movies all the time. So, you know, I even wonder with a movie like this, what about the audience that doesn't get it, that does think like, this is a very pro-war, let's go get the bad guys type movie, you know?
And well, like, it was funny because I was watching this in our living room yesterday, and my dad like had walked down and he's like, oh, what movie are you watching? And he like doesn't remember movies very well. And I said Apocalypse Now, and then he quoted that line. And like, that was what he remembered after.
What he took away from it.
Yeah, and I know that he hasn't seen this movie in probably decades, so it was just kind of funny, like you said, that that's kind of the standing line where it's like, ooh, like...
Well, it's definitely, like Coppola said, we brought it up earlier, like, it's definitely a movie where you're going to take from it what you bring in. And I think it's one of those movies where everyone's going to have a different reaction, and everyone's going to have a different interpretation. And that's kind of what makes it hard as an artist, too, because you obviously have your intention with the film, but you don't want to make it, like we were saying with war films, you don't want to make it so heavy-handed that it sounds like you're preaching to the audience. So I think especially with a war film, if you're going to go in the direction of viewer interpretation, you're basically setting yourself up for having, like, people that are just going to misinterpret it.
Well, and that character of the general, too, is, I feel like, a misinterpreted character, because at first glance, you take him as this comic relief, who's this guy who's not flinching at bombs while everyone else is getting on the ground, and he keeps talking about Lance and all this, but, like, you know, he wants to see Lance surf, so he blows up the whole tree line, and you're like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
Like, when you really, but you laugh about it at first, because that's what he's there for, and then the more you think about it, you're like, is this a character that I want to be laughing at? And he's the one that delivers that line.
The napalm line, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just this whole thing.
I do feel like there is something that we're kind of overlooking when we're talking about, like, the audience expectations, and that is that the film is literally titled Apocalypse Now. So I feel like, you know, that alone should dispel for a lot of people, like, you know, hey, this, we don't think this is a good thing because the apocalypse is not a good thing. But, you know,
right,
the fact that people still, even with that huge clue and the clue being the title of the movie, don't get it, like, it really fascinates me. Or maybe I don't get it. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe that's Coppola playing to me, going like, yeah, yeah, you dummy, it's called this to trick you.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, kind of wrapping things up, I think that's what makes the movie so interesting, even if maybe, like, I don't like everything about it, or Kayla, you don't like it. Like, I don't think any of us think it's, yeah, like, a perfect movie, but it makes it interesting and fun to talk about, because there's so many different angles you can take it, and there's so many different things you can talk about from either a historical standpoint or a intellectual standpoint. And so, like, I think that's what makes it a classic, and mm-hmm. what makes it, like, at least, like I said, something that you probably should watch at least once if you're interested in movies.
Yeah. Does anyone have any final thoughts that they really feel like they need to talk about?
I'll just say, for me, like, these are my favorite kind of movies, movies that lead to interesting discussions.
Mm, yeah.
And so, again, like, I would say this is one to, like, maybe get some of your friends together and kind of watch it and then talk about it. Because I think, you know, you'll, if you, like you see now, kind of, if you show three different people this movie, you're going to get three different opinions.
Yeah.
And I think that that's cool. I think that that's something that we should be, we should be welcoming into our communities as movie watchers.
Hmm.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that whole statement.
Yeah, I think Coppola knew that too, because, like, it's pretty widely known that, like, the film, especially, like, the theatrical version, like, his version he wanted aired, like, without opening and ending credits. So it's very specifically meant to be something that, like, is just one thing, and then once it's over, like, it's just over, and you have to kind of sit with it.
And it opens with that Doors song, The End, which I was in, like, from the minute that song started, I was like, yep, you got me.
Yeah, so, Zach, why don't you, I know you talked about your podcast a little bit, but why don't you plug where kind of people can find your guys' stuff? And then if you want to plug your personal social medias as well.
Yeah, sure. If you want to go to Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, we're The Real Boys, R-E-E-L, like a film reel.
Mm-hmm.
If you type that into Spotify or into Apple or Stitcher, all three of our shows will come up. Is It Really, Godfellas, and Fantasmic, which yours truly are going to be on a Fantasmic.
Yeah,
very
are.
Soon.
You definitely want to subscribe now to Fantasmic so you don't miss the episode that we're on.
Yeah,
super fun episode. I'm really excited to hear it.
Yeah, it was fun.
And if you want to follow me, I'm Smichaels72. On everything, on Twitter, Insta, and Letterboxd.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We'll link all that below in the show notes. Kayla, where can people find us if they want to?
Oh, yes. You can find us on Twitter at Secondhand Film and on Facebook and Instagram at Secondhand Film Pod.
Yeah, and you can subscribe to the show on all your favorite podcasting platforms. And if you would be so kind to leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, it helps us out in lots of different ways.
Our next episode, next Monday, will be some of our favorite summertime movies to catch the last, you know, we're going into the ends of summer here. So you gotta
catch those final rays.
Catch the final flicks.
Yeah.
Until next time, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Noah.
And I'm Zach.
And we're
your secondhand film critics.